Please listen carefully.
Welcome to A Public Affair. I'm Juanita Hurtado, your host for today, and we will be talking with linguistics professor Chase Raymond. He's now working at the University of Colorado Boulder with research focusing on what is known as situations of contact, moments when divergent languages, dialects, and cultures interact together, with a primary focus on the Spanish-speaking experience in the United States. We'll talk about linguistics and various aspects of what language is, unique experiences for multilingual people, the flawed concept of the ideal native speaker, and how languages affect topics like gender, identity, and sexuality.
So linguistics, broadly speaking, is the study of language. And so what that means is that from our perspective, humans have this special way that we communicate with each other. It's not the only way that we communicate with each other. We can communicate in lots of different ways, but language is definitely a primary one. And it's something that we have that other species don't have, other animals don't have. Other animals can communicate, of course, but they don't have this special system that we call language. So linguists are interested in figuring out how that system works. And so what that means is that it's a really diverse field because you can imagine, okay, these people are interested in language. Where is their language? Well, there's language everywhere. So what that means is the linguists are all over the place because if language is there, then there's going to be some type of linguist that's interested in what's going on there. Different people in linguistics, different researchers look at different types of things. So some folks are interested, for example, in sounds, and they're interested in how is it that this group produces this sound and that group produces this other sound, for instance. How is it that this language produces this sound or that language produces a sound? Some things like that. Then you've got other folks, and they're not really interested in sound, but they're interested in sentences. They're interested in how you put pieces of language together to make a sentence. So both of those people are linguists, for instance, right? Because they're both studying language, but they're just looking at it in different ways. My type of linguistics is called conversation analysis or interactional linguistics. I focus on language in real life. So some of my colleagues, for instance, will like bring people into a lab and put stuff on their head and do experiments with them or have them look at things and click and do all that kind of stuff. And I don't do those things. I'm interested in language kind of in the real world. And so my data is always real people out there in the real world doing things. So sometimes I'm in doctor's offices, video recording people talking to their doctors. Sometimes I'm looking at phone calls that are of people calling 911. Sometimes it's, you know, just family dinner conversation of people talking. But the point is, in all of these situations, there's language there. And language, we're doing stuff. I mean, right now, we're talking about what linguistics is, but I'm using language to do it, you know? And interestingly, in your comm class, you're using language. If you're taking a math class or a physics class, language is there. Language is part of the puzzle. So I'm interested in those real life sorts of contexts. But linguists as a whole, language is what we're interested in. So as you can imagine, it's really like if humans are there, then linguists are probably going to be interested in what's going on because language is probably going to be playing a role in what's going on.
Why is it important to have a study like linguistics? Does it evolve? Does it not evolve?
So I think there's two answers to that question. One is, there's an intrinsic sort of trying to figure out what this human resource is. So we're trying to figure out how it works because it's part of the human puzzle, trying to figure out part of what makes us human and how it ticks. Then there's applied interests where, for example, you can study something that your aim is to have some sort of direct impact. So for example, I did a study once on folks who call 911 and don't speak English. So you have 911, what's your emergency? And you get no hablo inglés or something like that, where it's like, but that's a real person that has a real emergency and is really calling 911. And so how can we make the system better for those sorts of callers? That would be a sort of applied a linguistics project where I would get a corpus of those sorts of calls and you work with them to try to figure out what's going on. And you say, hey, this works better than this. So let's do this. Let's not do this other one, right? So that's an example of something where linguistics kind of could and has had a direct impact. Another one is medicine, especially with doctors and patients that don't speak the same language when they have interpreters that come in. And there's a lot of work on what does your interpreter do? Are they a copy machine or are they doing more than just, you know, photocopying into another language? Is there kind of more involved there? Linguists, again, that's language doing stuff. So linguists will be interested in.
How is the experience different when you study linguistics for multilingual people? And how is it different for when you study linguistics for monolingual people?
It's really interesting because at kind of like a theoretical level, for a long time, we've talked about something called like the ideal native speaker of a language. And it's like this person, like you said, they were born and they grew up around this language. And so they speak this language. And that's like the ideal native speaker of a language versus someone. And that's like we're trying to study. So if we're trying to figure out like, what does Spanish do? How does Spanish work? That's the sort of speaker that we want. We don't necessarily want the person who's in like Spanish 1, right? You know what I mean? If I'm trying to figure out what Spanish is, I want that ideal native speaker. But what's really interesting is that for years, we've always kind of thought of that person, that like ideal, like in our imagination, as a monolingual speaker. But the majority of the people in the world are multilingual. So I don't know why we haven't really put these things together. I think there's a lot of like racism and things involved within the discipline for this. You know, it has like lots of English centric of histories in various sorts of ways. But one of the things that's interesting is that we're kind of challenging that. We're seeing, should our view of humans using language, our kind of default view, be one where there's more than one language going on? That there's lots of stuff. Why is our kind of like default one, like a monolingual, you know, speaker? What about one of these folks that grow up and they've got multiple languages, multiple, you know, kind of things going for? So that's kind of one of an interesting thing that's been talked about or being talked about now on that. But really, I think it depends, monolingual or multilingual, it really depends for me on who you're working with in terms of the data. So do you have a bunch of data where folks are speaking English? Well, then there's that. Do you have a bunch of folks where people are code switching English and Spanish? And that, well, then you've got that and both are there. So, you know, it's not a judgment thing in terms of one is right. It's what's in the data. What are real people doing? That's what we're interested in.
If you're just joining us, I'm Juanita Hurtado, your host for today's A Public Affair. And my guest is CU Boulder linguistics professor Chase Raymond, whose area of research focuses on what is known as situations of contact, moments when divergent languages, dialects, and cultures interact together, with a primary focus on the Spanish-speaking experience in the United States. We were discussing how the linguistic experience is different for multilingual people.
I'm sort of getting into this idea of like all connected Chicano, something that they don't have one mother tongue. They usually have two at the same time colliding as their own mother tongue. What we have known as French and English at the same time, this kind of thing. How does that change in linguistics affect this topic, like identity, like sexuality? I know, for example, I've read a couple of articles about how for Chicano communities, it is very hard for them to identify even in their own language, whether they are their Hispanic culture or their American culture.
Yeah. And you have this like ni de aquí ni de allá, like situation where you're in this like space, you know, this limbo space. And you have language comes in this a lot where you have, it's almost like in the research, it shows so much that Chicanos in various ways can't win in the sense that they get made fun of by folks for if they don't speak Spanish in the US, let's say, then they're like excluded in some sort of way, or their Spanish isn't good enough, or if their English is really good, then they're agringados, or they're, so this is all on this side of the border. Then at the same time, you go on the other side and you go and visit family, for example, in Guadalajara, then it's like, oh, you speak so funny. And eso no se dice. And aiga, ¿quién dice aiga? You know, things like this, where it's like, ¿cómo que quién dice aiga? Like, there is a huge community of people who say aiga, and it's perfect for their thing. And in medieval Spanish, it was aiga. And it's just over time, it's been accepted as now aya, for instance. So, but the point is that there's a lot of this research that shows exactly what you're saying, where you have this identity where you know who you are and you want to express this and stuff, but you have this resistance from the different parts of your identity on both sides of the border. You have, oh, you're, you know, agringados from this side, and you've got, you know, go back to Mexico from racists on the American side. And so you have this kind of in-between space that often manifests linguistically, where you have people not wanting to speak Spanish, you have people, you know, really wanting to speak English, vice versa, and so on. So language is really a big part, I think, of this identity question, not only from yourself, but also from other people looking at you, you know, and judging you of, I had a student come up after a lecture one time, whose last name was Gomez, and she did not speak Spanish. And we had talked about language loss and stuff across the family in that lecture. And it really resonated with her because she was like, it's not my fault that I don't speak Spanish. It's not my fault that my last name is Gomez and that my family did speak Spanish four generations ago. But because Spanish isn't set up for success and hasn't been set up for success in the US context, it has been lost in her family. And then to get made fun of by members of the community that you're not Chicana enough. Ugh, what a difficult space to be in, to then be told like, no cuentas como parte del club. You know, it's like
you have nowhere to belong.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So that's a really, I think your question about identity is a really good one. And it also, I think, emphasizes that it is that two-sided thing, you, how you feel, but also you're getting looked at by other people and judged. And so identity has that kind of two-sided thing. And because language is out there and public, it really has that two-sided thing to come out with it.
I know it also applies to immigrant communities who are very different country. I know I have a very thick accent and I look a little different. So for the Americans, I'm not American enough, even though I've been for years here. Mm. But for my Colombian counterparts, especially those that still live in my country, I've been Americanized already for a lot of expressions. And because now it's natural to speak both languages sometimes at the same time.
Yes.
So I absolutely understand that. But then again, like, for example, for a topic not like identity, but maybe sexuality, that doesn't work. Like I understand, for example, in Spanish, we don't have words like queer or like even trans. These words have been taken from English and associated in Spanish because we do not have a word, like awareness to this issue. So we take in English and turn it into our own.
That's very common. Languages love to do that. It's very common that languages will borrow concepts from other languages. It's very common with technology, for instance, because something gets invented in this context and then we all borrow it from that original invention. So sometimes languages try and invent a word, but oftentimes they're not successful. And so this is, so if you think of things like correo electrónico, me mandó un mail. So this is where it's like, it's not quite quick enough and people kind of got, you know, started using mail and in various dialects, et cetera. So borrowing things is very common. That's the first thing to say, is that we routinely borrow concepts from other languages. In this context, there's also the additional thing of just cultural stuff that's happening in one culture and another. And so it's common that social movements in one environment then affect social movements in other environments. So you see sort of cascades of these things. And so you have queer and trans movements, and then that language gets borrowed in various ways. It's interesting because it really shows the flexibility of language, right? It shows that like Spanish is not bound. It's not that like that the concept doesn't exist, and so you can't talk about it in Spanish. No, prestamos trans y ya. Like, it's like, you know what I mean? Y decimos queer y ya. Like, it's, you know, and it's easy, and we just move on with it. Another one that you might have an opinion about, what about concordancia? So Latinos and los Latinos en Estados Unidos deben blah, blah, blah. And so that's like masculine.
And oh, so impulsive language. That, yeah. That sort of connects with another one of my questions. Does the language we speak really affect the way we see some things? Because I understand, like, for example, when we talk about this sound,
exactly.
we think of it as a male.
Yeah, exactly.
The word in Spanish sort of gets into a male. And when we talk about the moon, it sort of reflects a female sort of thing. So how does that affect these kind of movements?
There is debate, of course, about this. On the one hand, there's the sort of linguistics in a very strict linguistic sense. But then there's also, in my view, sort of the movement aspect of it, where I almost set aside the linguistics. It's about inclusivity, and inclusivity for me is a good thing. However, there are various problems that have to be worked out. And for me, I say, let's talk about them. But other people say, y por eso no se puede. You know, they just like, you know, put the whole thing aside. Right. So for example, the pronunciation. For a while, people used to use arroba, like Latina, Latinos, Latinas, and arroba. But that the problem there is that that still recreates a binary between masculine and feminine. There are two options, you know, boy or girl, you pick between them. So that has then since been replaced with the X. But how do you pronounce Latinx? Right? That's difficult. Okay. Then we start to have to do les latines, for instance, les latines en Estados Unidos to be like an indefinite thing, or for a trans individual, for instance, because we need to pronounce a vowel there.
Yes.
In Spanish. So all I'm saying here is that there's some core linguistics stuff about the argument that needs to be, you know, worked out, and that people are working out, people have written on, et cetera. But I personally think that inclusivity is always a great thing. And the resistance to it is from the people that oftentimes you think would have resistance toward these things. I will say, though, that there is a reaction. I would love to hear your thoughts on this. I know that, you know, you're supposed to be interviewing me, but there is a reaction because a lot of the conversations started in the U.S. and amongst Spanish speakers in the U.S. So there is some reaction from Latin America and Spain that's like, don't worry about what's going on in Spanish. Let us worry about what's going on in Spanish. Like you said, you're overinterpreting it because for us, el sol y la luna, and like everything is gendered and it's not a problem. And so there is some reaction from folks that are from the Latin American and peninsular Spanish side. So what do you think about it?
I think there's obviously some sort of resistance, especially when it comes to movements, not only like social movements, but movements in general in the U.S., because we have such an influence from the U.S. in all of Latin America, in all Spain, that comes to this a sort of boundary of to what degree should we embrace the things these countries without giving up on our own roots. I know if there's something I've learned about Hispanic culture, we are very prideful. We will steal a lot of things. Like, I know it's very weird because sometimes all the representations you see about Latin countries, Spain, it's all of our traditional stuff that you don't think how alike we are. Like, I'm dressing the same way I will dress in my country. I'll probably use a lot of the same stuff because we have a really huge American influence. But the Gulf has created also a sort of resentment toward these kind of things. And this whole idea of like bringing movements and stuff, it is, I think it's like sort of double morale to the point like, yes, we want all the improvements you guys can give us.
Yeah.
Like we want the technology, we want the investigation, we want the scientific developments, but we don't necessarily want the things that get into the conflict with our tradition or old values in the culture. So all those kinds of conversations that the U.S. has already had, we still have to reconcile
Right.
But we don't own roots. Even yeah. like, this was a bit of a like worry of mine per se when it was the whole issue with Roe versus Wade.
Uh-huh.
Because right when the Roe versus Wade was overturned, my country, maybe a month or two ago, had depenalized abortion.
And
it was kind of the thing that you need to have backlash to those movements. That's something we know. When the Me Too movement comes, there's backlash. When the abortion movement comes, there's backlash. Yeah. Because that's how society works in itself. Right. But when it comes to these kind of things like abortion, how do you handle that kind of thing that you have the influence of American culture? So you are pushing for those things that you know are new and you want. But then we need backlash there while countries accepting it. How do you reconcile that? Some hard process.
Yeah, very true. The additional layer that goes on all of this is that then you move to another place. And so then you have the Colombian system and baggage. And then you come and now you have to deal with the American baggage, you know, and you also had it, but now you have it in a different way. And now when you go back and visit or when you go back, whatever, you'll have a different sort of baggage. And so in addition to the positives, obviously, that like come from the different experiences, you have, again, from that identity perspective, other people that are going to box you in different ways because of, you know, different things that you've done. The other thing I wanted to say about, we don't want the Americans in our business, like, you know, making these sorts of decisions. And I think it's a really interesting thing to be talking about because that brings up sort of like ownership of Spanish. And it's like, I get that. Like, don't tell us what to do with Colombian Spanish. But I mean, like, Spanish, obviously spoken in lots of different places and has lots of different things going on. And so the U.S. community of Spanish speakers is not an insignificant group. There are more Spanish speakers in the United States than in all of Spain. So if we're talking about the numbers, we're second only to Mexico in terms of number of people. So it's a big chunk of folk. To tell them constantly that they don't count as part of the Spanish-speaking club in various ways, that they say things they shouldn't, that they're doing this weird Les Latinas stuff and you shouldn't do that and whatever. I'm not saying that it's like the conversation's closed. I'm just saying to have the opinion that they don't, that those US speakers don't get to be part of the conversation. I think that's not a great, you know, idea.
It was hard to start hearing people talking this Spanish that is sort of like machacado, but then
I'm doing
the same thing with English. So it sort of comes to this idea like, does it make my voice any less valid because I use a language different to yours? No, it doesn't.
No. And you can already see this goes in with the other identity questions. Now you add race to that. You add gender. You add other of these complexities that make the situation even more intersectional in terms of these identities.
It does affect the way we view the world because language in itself is a reflection of the society you live in. So when it comes, for example, the Chicano and the Spanglish in the U.S., you cannot expect a person who is talking 50% of the time in Spanish and 50% of the time in English to not have this combination or this collision of languages.
Right.
It happens. And yes, there are moments they're going to adapt certain words like laundry or carpeta or these kind of things to their language because that's how they, like, that's the moment in history they're living in.
Yeah.
Just like we know it changes for socioeconomic status. When a person of a very high class is going to talk completely different from a person from a very low class. So if language represents all of this, we cannot like put in a box the whole idea of how do you speak proper Spanish or how do you speak proper English or how you speak proper any language. I think it does come to this whole issue of oppression, of how do you eliminate voices that you don't want to hear.
100%. And indeed, when we start talking about this person speaks better than that person or like any of these sorts of ideas that we have, it's not really about the air coming out of their mouth. It's about the mouth that it's coming out of. So it's exactly what you said. That's not a group that I really want to hear from. And oh my gosh, what a coincidence. Their way of speaking happens to be the bad way of speaking. Isn't it interesting that those two things always go together? You know, isn't it interesting that the good way of speaking is always the way that, you know, rich upper middle class people, you know, speak? In the context of like standard American English, is it Black vernacular English? No, that's a different dialect. We have that sort of standardized thing, but it has nothing to do with language. It has nothing to do with like verb conjugations or something. It's just another language or another dialect. It has to do with the fact that the speakers of that are a group of speakers that we don't want in power. We want to keep them oppressed. And so we're going to make sure that way of speaking doesn't get the same clout as the way this other group is. So it's exactly what you said. You said oppression earlier. And it's exactly that. When any of these conversations about prestige, you know, I speak this fancy version, or this is the good way of saying that, or all of that kind of stuff, those are all based on social things. It's race and class and all. It's never about language itself. Like, that's always the funny thing, because it's always like, you know, in English, you don't do as a double negative. Doesn't make sense. I don't have no potato. Oh my gosh, it's totally illogical. Well, hello, Spanish. You know what I mean? That does double negative obligatorily. So for every, oh my gosh, language, linguistics, that's not the way that it works. That's why it has to be that way. That's why my version is better than your version, because it makes sense. It's never about the language stuff. I like to say it's never about what's coming out of the mouth. It's never that language stuff. It's about the mouth that it's coming out.
Thank you for listening to A Public Affair. And a special thanks to our guest, CU Boulder's linguistic professor, Chase Raymond. You can learn more about Professor Raymond's research on his webpage, chasewesleyraymond.com. For KGNU, I'm Juanita Hurtado.